You use the microphone so that both it'll be recorded so that you can hear it again when you download it from the internet, and also so that I can hear it for the first time. So do you have anything you'd like to say or ask? What, you're in church? Whomever. There's somebody back there, but
hi.
Hi.
I'll go first. I don't know if I can stay the whole day, and I want to approach the situation with equanimity. I'm struggling with it. My daughter is ill and has been very unstable, and so I may need to be called away at any moment, and that's a normal situation for me. And it's one I struggle with approaching with equanimity, so I wanted to ask.
Okay. Did you all hear that? You know, I'm glad you asked also, because it's this is all about real life, you know, and what we do is in a way it's like a training for real life. And I think having equanimity in these kinds of situations doesn't mean that we have no preferences, that we don't feel sorrow at missing an opportunity or having to leave abruptly or not being able to finish something. I mean, of course we do. But how completely do we get immersed in it, in that reaction, is the question. And how much can we experience the truth that our desire is not going to be met, that we have other responsibilities or we have to leave or there's something else going on, and have a kind of open-heartedness about that. And that is both difficult and enormously liberating, because it's the truth of how things are. I think we do ourselves a disservice when we equate equanimity with having no feeling at all. Like, oh no, I failed the equanimity test because I had a reaction at having to leave, or, you know, I'm the weakest one here at equanimity because I continually resent this situation. I mean, of course we resent it, or we have sorrow, or we have some reaction, and we need to allow ourselves that. But as with everything, it all depends on how we relate to that reaction. You know, do we dive completely into it? Does it overtake the rest of our day? Whenever we kind of solidify a situation and are defined by that situation, whether it's an internal reaction or an external reaction, we miss whatever else comes up that also might be quite beautiful or interesting or challenging in its own way, but we don't even notice it because we're still back at whatever. You know, I couldn't stay, or my plane is late, or whatever it might be. I was just thinking, as I was sitting here waiting for you all, about I went to California just pretty recently to help assist one of my own teachers, this Tibetan teacher, Sokhne Rinpoche, teach a retreat. And he ended up stuck in London because of the volcanic ash and never showed up at all. But day after day after day, we kept thinking, oh, maybe tomorrow. And it was really powerful for everybody. There were like 150 people there dealing with their disappointment and dismay and thwarted expectation, and people had traveled from everywhere to see him. And of course, it was very interesting for me. It was like, you know, the understudy or something on the play. I mean, he had a friend there who was there, I think, just to be with him, a Tibetan Lama, and he had to take over the role of the teacher. So everyone had to adjust wildly. And It was very challenging and very intense, and by the end I felt like we'd all come through something together in a very special way. And I could also imagine never leaving aside the resentment and thereby never appreciating. I mean, I found this other teacher very beautiful and very special, and he lives in the States, and I never would have discovered him. It was very quietly. So there was a treasure, you know, that just popped up out of nowhere, or the kindness of somebody, or the sense of presence one can have. In India, they have this very famous saying that if a pickpocket meets a saint, they will see only the saint's pockets. You know, and so when we are completely lost in a reaction, which is different than feeling the reaction, but when we're locked in there, then we are living in a very narrow band. We miss everything else that might come up. And so that's why we want to feel it genuinely, learn to relate to that kind of reaction in a different way so that we can go on and have the joys and sorrows that actually are coming our way instead of just living, you know, within that little prison, that little confine. And so that's our possibility. That's what we're actually practicing. I was teaching several times, as it turned out, as it just happened, with a friend of mine named Mark Epstein, who's a psychiatrist in New York City, and he's written several books on Buddhism and psychotherapy. He almost sort of began the field. And Mark was talking about somewhere we were teaching together, and he was talking about how he began his meditation practice in 1974. And not every year throughout these years, but most years throughout these years, he's tried to do one retreat a year, say 7 days, something like that, as well as having his own daily practice. So he said pretty much every year he went to do a 7-day retreat, and he'd bring a notebook, the same notebook. He actually pulled out the notebook. I found it rather small. I thought, that's a small notebook. But anyway, he'd bring a notebook, and he would write down kind of the major insight he'd have during the course of the retreat, or he often practiced with Joseph and some other teachers as well. And he said, and he'd also write down kind of the major illuminating, life-changing message that whoever he was practicing with would say. So his own personal insight and whatever teaching had major significance for him. So he said a few years ago he decided to pull out the notebook and read through it. And he discovered that he pretty much each year been writing down exactly the same thing. And it was all a variation on this one message, which was, what arises is not so important. How we relate to what arises is most important. Now, so the anger arises. We all tend to think, oh God, I failed. It doesn't matter. How are we with that anger? How much compassion do we have for ourselves with that anger? How much presence? How much balance? This arises, that arises. So I thought that was very funny, you know, of course. And I thought, well, probably I'm the same way. Probably I probably learn the same thing again and again and again and again and again, just at deeper and deeper levels. But it is so fundamental, and it's very tough for us. That is a very challenging message, because we're very judgmental. We're very content-oriented, like, I felt this, that's wrong, that's right. Rather than, how was I with that feeling? How much presence, how much balance, how much compassion? And yet, within that, look at the truth of that and how freeing that is, that we can have so many feelings come up and either be with them in a way that opens us to others and love and balance, or we can get locked in over and over again, and it's the same feeling, but we're with it in a completely different way. And so that's our practice. That's what we do, you know, both here and in life. Poor Chris. That's a hard job.
As I was walking, my attention was on the bottoms of my feet and the sensation of the pressure. But then I noticed all kinds of feelings and process and things that seemed really important that I wanted to pay attention to. But I thought, oh no, actually, I'm meant to be, well, not meant to be, but yeah, I had that thought of,
yeah,
I need to be focusing elsewhere. So I felt I couldn't hold it all, hold it in my awareness, the feelings and the process and the movement. So a bit of a dilemma.
Yeah. I mean, definitely that can happen. And, you know, some teachers have said to me, just very simply, stop walking at that time and more fully be with the range of feelings or emotions or insights or whatever may be coming up. And when you feel that has settled down somewhat, then you can pick up the walking again. And it's totally fine. One of the enormous pleasures about being on a retreat like this is that there's so much flexibility. And if you stop, you know, no one cares. Although we, you know, might feel very self-conscious. But I once was practicing with this Burmese teacher, Sayadaw Pandita, at IMS, and he told me something like, he was directing me to try to be aware of the intention behind a movement, like before I move my hand. There's actually sometimes a very subtle intention in the mind to do that. And he said, say if you're sitting in the dining room and you stand up without having left space to notice the intention, or you may notice it or not, but at least leave the space to see if you can pick it up. He said, so if you're in the dining room and you stand up without having left space to notice the intention, sit down again and then do it again. And I thought, yeah, right. You know, that's what I'm going to do in the dining room, stand up and sit down. And then I realized, it doesn't matter. You know, I have nothing else to do, really. And so it's kind of like that. If something very strong, and you have to sense yourself how strong it is, comes up, you can just stop walking, stand there, pay full attention to whatever, and then when you're ready, just resume.
Hi. I'm really struggling at the moment with my practice. The deeper I get into it, the less I am able to engage with the real world because it seems such an insane illusion. So I'm not very full of equanimity ever anymore. I just don't know how to practice but continue to engage with the planet as it is.
Let me just ask you a couple of questions, so keep the microphone for a moment. When you say an insane illusion, is that something that brings up anger or distress?
Yeah, anger most of the time. I'm dealing with human rights abuses and things in Africa. And the more I know about it, and the whole collusion of everybody, I just find it harder to deal with.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay, I just wanted to clarify what illusion meant. Well, that's very understandable. And it's interesting and I think powerful because that's precisely where equanimity is talked about, where we're trying to make a difference and it's gruesome and we feel hopeless and helpless and frustrated, and it's so common that those feelings take center stage and then we just withdraw. It's it's right there, you know, in this situation that we talk about equanimity. And it's not easy. You know, I would never want to be glib or frivolous and say that it's easy. But I also see that the people who inspire me the most in that way, through their service, through their efforts to make this a better world, have some kind of perspective that's so big that they are able to sustain an effort through enormous frustration and feelings of futility. And so I'm always struck by that, and that, because, you know, it's the easiest thing in the world. And in a way, it's so much a part of our makeup to think about, well, I'm not going to work. Look at this. It's so horrible, and it's getting worse, and, you know, I'm not contributing anything or whatever it might be. And not just in a global sense, but even in one's personal life, trying to make a difference with one friend. And coming up right away against that lack of control that we have. It's not easy. I once went to this teacher, Sukhini Rinpoche, about a friend, because he was really not in a good way, and it felt like it was never going to change, and it was just going to last forever, and I didn't know how to help him. And I went to this teacher and I said, it's not fair. You know, why don't we get one person where we can just point to them at some point and say, poof, your suffering's over. I just don't think it's fair. And of course, that's complicated too. It's like, which person and how do you choose and when do you do it? You don't want to do it too soon, but you don't want to do it too late. And Sukhini Rinpoche, he just laughed. You know, he laughed and he laughed and he said, this is why we call it samsara. You know, this is why we call it this world of birth and death and constant change and things being out of control. This is the nature of things, that we don't get one person. But that doesn't mean our efforts are ineffectual or make no difference. And this is sort of the crux of the matter. It's like having a huge perspective. That admits how much we don't know, that doesn't give up, that doesn't let our own feelings of helplessness rule the day, is very difficult, and it's possible. So we practice in small ways and bigger ways. Some of the exploration has to do with exploring time, patience. Some of it has to do with exploring the nature of compassion. Like, what does compassion actually mean? And can we find a balance in that compassion so that it doesn't fall off into more a state of despair? And when it does, can we learn how to retrench and renew and not feel bad about that? Like, with that awful guilt we can feel, feeling indulgent. I went to, in America, outside of Washington, D.C., I went to Walter Reed Army Hospital once to teach, where wounded soldiers come. And it was National or International Nurses Week. And so I was invited to teach the nurses. They had all kinds of programs for them that week. And I got the invitation because one of my students, one of my friends, is a nurse there. And so she made this arrangement. She also made an arrangement for me for a tour, a short tour of one of the wards, and which we did before I was teaching. And of course, it was, you know, intense and painful and hard to be there, even, you know, just for an hour. It was very difficult. And at the end of the tour, she turned to me and she said, you know, the nurses who can stay here, meaning the nurses who can continue to serve there, The nurses who can stay here are not the ones who get lost in sorrow. The nurses who can stay here are the ones who can connect to the resiliency of the human spirit. And there it was. I thought, oh, that's it. You know, that's like a different definition of compassion. And, you know, part of it is that when one is dealing with a whole traumatized population, one gets sort of traumatized often oneself, that one's own healing or resiliency is not necessarily prized within a system, and so you really have to be kind of bold to say, I need this, I need to take care of myself too, I need to have this kind of replenishment. Part of it is changing perspective. Sometimes it's looking at the small things, the single triumph, the one person. Sometimes it's going bigger with perspective and realizing that lots of efforts don't bear fruit right away. You know, it can take a very long time, but that doesn't mean it can happen without this small piece and that small piece. So there's a lot. You know, there's lots of levels to it. And really, it's honoring that you need to take care of yourself too. You know, that I think starts that whole process of having that kind of flexibility and creativity. And that's not easy either for anybody. I often say, it's funny how hard daily practice is, even if it's just 20 minutes a day. And I often say, well, it's kind of funny, isn't it? Most of us, if someone told us, well, here's this thing you can do 20 minutes a day, and it'll really help your friend, most of us would do it. But to think that it will really help me, it's like, I don't feel so good about that. You know, that makes me a little squeamish. But helping me really does help my friend too. Otherwise, I'll just burn out. I'll just be exhausted. So it's all of that, and we'll keep talking about it because it's, I think, right at the, like the other question, it's right at the heart of what we're doing.
You mentioned earlier on something about being angry with oneself, and last time I was very angry with myself. And while I was walking, I thought, I was angry with myself because there's some sort of transformation or change that I'm terrified of. And I put myself in situations where it could happen, but then I get really cross because of whatever it hasn't happened. I'm not aware, but I became aware. I just wondered if you could say something about that.
So you're finding yourself in situations where some kind of transformation is possible but not actualized. And then you get angry because you feel you're obstructing it?
I think I get angry because I sense the potential and become afraid and draw, not too far back, but just move back a bit, so I get really furious with myself because something about it's not quite right or I haven't done the right thing. But then I realized it really is about fear of some sort of deep kind of change that is happening, but is, and which, as far as I'm conscious, I want, but it's absolutely terrifying at another level.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would, you know, actually do a little twist on what you said in that. I don't think that the drawing back stops a process. So I think we're putting different elements of transformation in place. And you can't really evaluate or measure, like, well, it should have happened this afternoon, but it didn't, you know, I shouldn't have skipped that walking and done that, otherwise it would have happened. We don't know. Actually, we can only continually begin again and try to relate to our experience, both the fear and the anger and the peace when that's there and the come in as open-hearted a way as possible. Then it's all part of the process. Does that make any sense? Sort of reminds me of, I used this example yesterday, I guess, in talking to somebody that comes from the Buddha. A version of it, you know, is something like a mind, like your mind or my mind, will get filled with qualities like mindfulness and loving kindness moment by moment, the way a bucket will get filled with water drop by drop. So a mind will get filled with qualities like mindfulness and loving kindness moment by moment, the way a bucket will get filled with water drop by drop. And as soon as I heard that example, I really liked it, because right away I could imagine myself standing by that bucket, looking inside and thinking, won't it be glorious when I'm fully enlightened? And I'm back in New York, floating down the streets, just totally calm and happy, but not bothering to add the next drop. Or I could easily, certainly imagine myself standing by the bucket and looking inside and thinking, that's really dreary. That's pretty empty. And once again, not bothering to add the next drop. The drops get added by how we relate to this moment's experience. Whether it's a pleasant experience or a painful experience or a neutral experience, that's how the drops get added. And everything else is like a story we tell ourselves. It's never going to happen. It's going to be glorious when it happens. But what about now? What about right now? What am I feeling right now? Can I be mindful of it? Can I have loving kindness toward myself in the face of it? What about now? And now, since I started using that example in teaching, somebody came up with another really good one. I'm sure there are many more. But somebody described themselves standing by that bucket and completely overlooking it in order to peer into someone else's bucket. How are you doing over there? You're really going well over there. There's all kinds of possibilities. But, it, you know, I liked it because of the sense of immediacy. Okay, I'm in this situation. I'm filled with fear. How am I relating to the fear? I'm in this situation. I'm filled with anger. How am I relating to the anger? I'm in this situation. I'm filled with joy. How am I relating to the joy? And that way, it's very empowering too, because if you're just thinking, well, I shouldn't be feeling what I'm feeling, we don't know how to not feel what we're feeling. But we can relate very differently to what we're feeling, and that's a path.
My question, I think, relates a little bit to your story of your friend whose book of insights is the same every year. And I feel that I've also got lots of books on my shelves where I've read this stuff, and you have little sayings that comfort me, little self-tips like it too will pass and no destination and whatever it might be. And that, but then I, what I find odd is how often we have to remind ourselves. It's just mm-hmm. constant. And in a way, you know, while I'm in this room where I've got it all at home, you know, maybe I just need to try and be mindful as much as I can all throughout the day. And I suppose to an extent I feel there's a weakness to be in this room, because I just do know it all from it's just this, it's somehow, I think it's a design fault that we, once we crack it, remember it again and again. And so in a way, I'm not entirely in short of my questions, except that I suppose it's slightly wide enough to keep remembering why I can't just lodge it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, just the sort of, in a way, why do we yet again have to buy another CD, another tape, another book, when they are all essentially saying the same thing? I've already absorbed, and then unabsorbed, and need to reabsorb again.
Well, I have another book coming out in January. This is a very funny question to ask an author. Well, you don't actually need to buy another CD or another book. You really don't. could if you wanted to. You really don't need to, because the whole point is one's own practice, which is difficult. And different situations, different books, different gatherings, different opportunities help remind us in a way that really helps build a greater ease with our own practice. But it's going to come down to that anyway, in the end. And that probably means, it means for most people, having some kind of daily discipline. And I often say, and it's true, I think that the dailiness of it is more important, generally speaking, than the length of time. And the reason it tends to come down to a daily discipline is because we need to remember, just as you said, in some confrontation at work, we need to remember to breathe. In being on some mode of transportation, which necessarily implies an in-between time, we haven't reached our destination yet, we need to not just fill in the space with agitation. And the tools we use are not so elaborate or difficult that one can barely imagine understanding or using them, but we have to remember to use them. And so everything will come down to that. And so that's why, even though theoretically one never needs to formally practice, you can just be mindful or extend loving kindness in any situation. Certainly, that's true. But is it really true for me, you know, today or tomorrow? Unlikely. You know, for me, I've discovered that, just like all my teachers said, that having a daily practice is going to be the springboard for more readily remembering in different situations. Then you have to think, what's going to help my daily practice? And people ask, over and over again, I get asked, you know, should I sit alone or with others? Should I sit in the morning or should I sit in the evening? Should I sit at the same time every day? Should I sit in the same place every day? And I always say, it depends on what works for you. You know, one could say the morning is the best time to sit, but if that's completely unrealistic in your life, then don't sit in the morning. Because the important thing is the doing of it. And that's very difficult. You think 20 minutes would be nothing, and it's very difficult to just stop whatever one is doing, to take care of ourselves, to care, to return to that kind of simplicity. Is very difficult. But it's what we need to do, above all. And for everyone, there are going to be different means that help inspire us or remind us or help us keep it real, which is the whole point. And I would also say, I was in a conference somewhere where different scientists have been doing research on compassion meditation, and they were presenting their findings to the Dalai Lama, and it was very interesting, actually. It was a great study, but one of the things they were trying to analyze, they had this program where people were doing compassion meditation, I think it was half an hour a day for a month or something like that. And after 2 weeks, they were discovering some very big brain changes, positive changes, in people who were doing the meditation, half an hour a day, just 2 weeks. But one of the things they were trying to figure out was the dose response, as they call it in medicine or pharmaceuticals. You know, it's like if you take an aspirin 3 times a day, is that better than once a day? Or if you take it, whatever. So I was always quite amused that they were talking about meditation in terms of the dose response. And they said something like, you know, the people who meditated 5 times a week were getting a better result than the people who meditated twice a week. And the biggest difference was between those people who just thought about meditating and those people who actually did it. And that's it. You know, it's like, we got to do it. Otherwise, we're just in some fantasy. Like, wouldn't it be great? Or as people often say to me in New York City, if only I didn't live in New York, where it's so noisy. You know, there was the Buddha sitting under a tree. Fine for him, but, you know, this is too noisy. I'm too busy. I'm too stressed. There's too much going on. I'm too tired. There's a lot of reasons that come up. But it's only the doing of it that's really going to make the difference. So I was very amused by the dose response. I thought, wow. That would be an interesting grant to get. Yeah.
Why is the mind so eager to distract itself or to stir it all up?
I don't know. I really don't know. It's remarkable, isn't it? But we can, you know, I mean, some of the most tender examples are things like training a puppy. You know, just we can be kind to ourselves, even as our minds are rambunctious and naughty and, you know, flying all over the place. It's like, okay, I'm just training the puppy. It's like, okay, you just do it again, you do it again, you do it again. You see a difference. But clearly we're conditioned, you know, it's just habit. And training, both personal and cultural and, you know, all kinds of things. And so hopefully with a lot of kindness toward ourselves, we can engage in that training process.